Welcome! Welcome to ArtCast. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, back again with another installment from my time at BS Live San Francisco, which was a really great event, a lot of fun, and I spent hours and hours just interviewing people. You have no idea. We have some really interesting guests still to come from BS Live San Francisco. And have you ever wondered, how does a person get to speak at an event like this? You know, like, what do you got to do, and where do you get hooked up with that? Well, today, on this show, you're going to listen to Benjamin Day, and he is a first-time BS Live speaker. And so I asked him about, you know, how he got hooked up into this whole thing. It was kind of interesting. And we're going to be talking about one of his sessions that he did on nHibernate, which is an open-source framework for doing object persistence. Kind of interesting stuff. So let's give it up for Benjamin Day. Well, I am sitting here today, once again, at BS Live San Francisco, where I'm joined by Benjamin Day.
How's it going?
Good, good. So, Benjamin, or do you go by Ben?
Ben works.
Ben? Okay. So, I think this is the first time we've met. Is this one of the first VS Lives you've done?
This is the first VS Live that I've ever spoken at. Actually, the first large conference I've ever spoken at.
Wow. So, it's kind of, you know, hit the big time here,
yeah,
huh?
No kidding.
Now, how did you get into that?
Well, I met Richard Hale Shaw at a user group meeting last year, and we just became friends over time, and he suggested that I submit some abstracts, and tossed in four or five abstracts. They picked up two, and here I am.
See, you never know what's going to happen.
It was totally wild, actually. The story of how we came to become friends actually goes back to my music degree. So,
Oh, you have a music degree?
Yeah.
I do, too.
Good.
Isn't that funny?
What was your instrument?
Piano.
Mine was jazz voice, and then I did piano on the side, actually.
Oh, yeah. See, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Isn't that fun? You know, and my mother always worried how I was going to make a living with a music degree.
We didn't.
Yeah, that's right. We didn't make a living with it. You know, but it was a good way to get through school.
Yeah. Better than nothing.
Well, I found, you know what I found about that is that music is the kind of thing that either you got it or you don't, right? You can't, like, just study and try to get it.
Right.
Because I saw people like that who came into the program, and they'd study their brains out and knock their head against the wall, and they would not get it.
Yeah.
And then I would just, like, loaf and ace the test and, you know.
Yeah. That was kind of my thing. So the academic side was always a joke.
Uh-huh.
I had professors that were telling me, it's like, yeah, if you want to do it, you could probably do it. But the thought of going to Manhattan and making $14,000 a year and just scraping it out just didn't really work for me. So
yeah, that's a tough go, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, so here we are in the computer biz,
nerds,
musical nerds,
yes.
But nerds nonetheless. Okay, so and this week you're speaking about what?
Oh, I've got two. Tonight I'm going to be speaking on rights-based security. And tomorrow I'm doing one on intro to nHibernate development.
And you got your start speaking at user group meetings.
Right.
Yeah. Well, see, there's some value in those.
It's
right?
Really valuable. It's good exercise.
Yeah. See, they didn't have those when I was first starting out, you know, in this business. So, you know, I just, I would stay, you know what? It's so funny. You reminded me of the story because you look fairly young to me, right?
So 31.
You're 31? Well, see how old I'm getting. That looks young to me. But when I was first starting out in the business, I wanted to learn a lot and, you know, had a music degree. So, I was working at this place and they had a PC. This was way back in 86, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they had one PC.
Yeah.
And I thought it was the coolest thing, you know, this little C prompt and the flashing cursor there, and like, what do you do with it? And they go, you type CD / and all this stuff, you know. And so I started reading the manual because back then they used to ship a DOS manual, which is kind of like your basic manual, and then they would ship the complete technical reference manual.
Wow.
That was IBM, you know, that was their thing. And in the technical reference manual, it had low-level descriptions of, like, the BIOS and
cool.
CPU registers and all these things, you know, all these assembly language stuff. I had no idea what it meant, but I was fascinated by reading it. So, anyway, that's how I got my start.
Nice.
All right. So, so you had rights-based security tonight,
mm-hmm.
but the other one is what?
nHibernate. It's an open-source object relational mapping framework.
Yeah, now that's real interesting because I looked at InHibernate some time ago. Maybe it was like maybe a year and a half ago or something. Mm-hmm. And it's a .NET port of a Hibernate thing, which is a Java. Is that the Java one is Hibernate, or did they have
Java? Java is Hibernate, and that actually has been around for a good couple of years, 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And, they got around to porting it to .NET.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, I looked at it, I guess it had to be about a year, year and a half ago.
Yeah.
So it was fairly in, you know, kind of rough shape.
Pretty beta.
Yeah. And I didn't get very far. I just looked at it a little bit because I was curious about it. But what do you think about InHibernate?
Well, I had kind of the same reaction. A friend of mine, who's also a .NET architect, got hooked up on a Java project, and he came back. He's like, this Hibernate thing's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And it took me a little while to get won over to it. But after I did, you know, it started to dawn on me that we're all talking this good line that we're trying to develop, you know, object-oriented N-tier systems, and we're all domain model of business objects, rah-rah. And the problem with that is that you have to write an awful lot of code to actually make that happen. And once I started digging into InHibernate, I could see, it's like, well, this is pretty much taken care of all this stuff, so that you can write really nice, clean domain model business objects and, you know, write your little mappings in XML, and then InHibernate takes care of all of your saves, your deletes, your loads, your updates, and it saves you a lot of time, so it frees you up to really concentrate on the business problem instead of the persistence issues.
Well, you know, when the reason I was looking at InHibernate is because at the time I was on the Patterns Practices team, and, you know, so they build enterprise library and other kinds of application blocks and things, which are, you know, very close to open source stuff, right? We would never say that, because open source, we would never say that word. Okay, but we said shared source.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, but anyway, so people were always asking me, are you guys going to build like an object relational mapping thing? And we thought about it, you know, and there was this project that was intended to be in .NET that got canceled.
Is that object spaces?
Yeah. You remember that one? Yeah. And there was some thought about, well, why don't we take object spaces and release it as an application block? We thought about that for a while and we looked at InHibernate and whatnot, but there was a lot of debate between people who thought that some people think object relational mapping is like awesome, great, love it, got to have it.
Yep.
And other people say it's a bad idea because it's a potent weapon. It's like giving a six-year-old a loaded gun,
right?
You know, and they might shoot themselves in the foot. And because there are some things that when you're dealing with a database, some things that are kind of, to me, large set-oriented operations.
Mm-hmm.
And if you try to do those with object relational mapping tools, you get very lousy performance.
Mm.
And so it's hard for sometimes people to distinguish when they ought to use object relational mapping or when they shouldn't. Have you run into that with this?
One of the things that I think could give you the lousy performance is, you know, I'm not that familiar with object spaces. I was really disappointed when it didn't come out, though.
Mm-hmm.
InHibernate defines this attribute on a lot of the relationships and the collections, so that if you're using mapped objects and say person has you know, direct reports collection, so direct reports is a collection of other employees that, you know, work for the master employee. You can define this attribute called lazy. You say set lazy equal to true, and InHibernate will stuff in a lazy loading proxy when you load up that person. And until you actually go after that collection of direct reports, it will not go out and try to load those other objects. So that's one way that it solves that performance problem. But you're right. There's some stuff that you don't get the direct granular control over just exactly what's going on all the time. But in a lot of ways, since it's one of those 80-20, you know, balance it out. It's like, well, if you can get your application developed, you know, N times faster, and it does what you need it to do But the performance, you take a, say, a 5 or 10% performance kick, I think a lot of companies and clients would probably look at that and say, all right, good enough.
Well, yeah, and I mean, honestly, a lot of people sweat over performance so much. I mean,
right.
And we're like sweating it, and then for the vast majority of apps, it doesn't matter that much.
And hardware is cheap. It's almost heresy to say this, but if your performance sucks, it's like you could probably throw another box at it or you know, add some more memory and ring it out. So your code is running a little slower, but there are ways around.
Well, sometimes. Sometimes you can do that. But there are some things you can't buy your way out of. But,
right.
But you know, it's like I was just downstairs talking to Pat Helland, who is a former colleague of mine, who's now at Amazon.com, right?
Oh, cool.
And he's talking about, you know, architecting for scalability. And,
right.
And, of course, there's few people that need to scale like Amazon.com does, right?
Right.
But you know, it's kind of fun to listen to those talks, you know, and think, wow, you know, my 15 users will really get this.
Right, exactly. Kick. Yeah, if you're working on an application that's got 15 users or 100, it's like, it's not so much of an issue. But if you're Amazon, you're probably not going to use Inhibernate for your...
Yeah, right. Well, and in fact, I think where it really gets people is when you give them a tool that's really, really convenient like this, they go, oh, well, I'm just going to use that for everything. So then they go, well, I need to populate a list box with, you know, the 10,000 customers or whatever.
Right.
So they go use Inhibernate to, create 10,000 customer objects and in an array and then put them in there. That's going to be really lousy performance when they could just go off and get a data reader and stuff that thing full.
Well, actually, that reminds me of a blog entry that I wrote. So if you go to my blog, blog.benday.com, you can kind of read through my mindset shift.
Uh-huh.
And so towards the beginning, I wrote some blog entries where I'm really pretty skeptical about Inhibernate and the value. And it was stuff like that where, you know, you just need to populate a dropdown or something like that. Or what if you're... I think that the example that I use is, what if you need to do complex searching? So you're writing some sort of a ad hoc reporting system or something like that, and you know the SQL you want to do, and it's a real just complicated SQL statement. And I got really hung up on that. It's like, well, why would you do it in Inhibernate? It's just a lot of extra stuff. And I talked to some guy in Texas. I'm going to butcher his name, Ben Shearman. And he basically said, render unto Inhibernate that which is Inhibernate, and render unto ADO what is ADO's. So in a case like that, if you know you've got a stored proc that can just bang that out, or you can write really complicated SQL and just fire it off, you do that, and you optimize for what's good and optimizable. But for things like pulling out your object model and really working with your business objects, in a case like populating the dropdown, you really don't need your business objects. You just need probably the value, the underlying value of that primary key, and then the text.
Yeah.
But if you're populating larger screens, you're probably using your more rich object model.
Okay. I have to admit, I'm still on the skeptic side with Inhibernate.
Hey, that's cool. Come to my talk, and I'll try to win you over. What do you think?
Well, you know...
Probably
it's just because I haven't spent any serious time with it. You know, if you spend a little bit of time, you know, it's always like the first reaction to any large kind of framework thing. The first reaction is, I don't want to have to learn this.
Yeah.
Let me look for reasons why this won't work.
Yeah. Well, and that's that same conversion process. So the friend that initially hit me to Inhibernate, for the longest time I was like, I've written a custom code generator that I can just point it at my database tables, gen up my CRUD store procs. It'll generate all my enterprise library code. I just put it in. Who cares?
Yeah.
And he was just like, yeah, I don't know. You're crazy. And over time, I just kept sort of picking at it. And I just like it.
You know, and the other thing that's, I think that the people who, the community that builds these kind of frameworks miss, right, is they don't give the kind of training resources that you need to kind of really get going.
Right.
You know, and so like with Enterprise Library, we did things like make quick starts, make hands-on labs,
yep.
we do webcasts and explain it all. And
yep.
you know, but there's nobody doing that for things like this, except for, well, you come to a conference, you might hear, you know, a session like you're talking
about. Actually, a lot of the stuff that's on my blog about Enhibernate is trying to fill that space.
Yeah.
So I wrote a sample application to kind of jumpstart people and walk them through some of the big problems. Like one of the biggest ones that seems to kill everybody is when you want to use Enhibernate from an ASP.NET application. And the Enhibernate defines a session. And when you're loading objects, your objects are parented back to this session. And the Enhibernate session takes care of the persistence and, you know, whether or not you've changed something or whatever. So if you're in an ASP.NET web environment, you have fairly short-running requests. So you're loading up your objects and you're dropping them right away. And how do you make that work with the Enhibernate session? And there were some ideas out on the Enhibernate forums, but no one really had a sample app. So I took some of those ideas and came up with a sample app that is actually, I'm kind of happy, gets a lot of traffic and a lot of downloads.
Ah, cool. Well, you know what? So send me a link for that,
and
we'll post it with this episode, and maybe you'll get even more.
Yeah. Hey, that'd be kind of cool.
All right. So, but we've been talking a lot about Enhibernate, but maybe for some people who are listening, they're going, I have no idea. What is it?
Right.
Let's start with that. What is it?
Okay. It's this thing, you know? It solves your data access needs. So they have a mission statement on the Enhibernate site or the Hibernate site that says their goal is to solve, say, 90% of the data access needs that your developers are going to need. So what you do is you have your object model, you know, where you're modeling up all of your entities, and then you've got this XML mapping document where you say, this class maps off to this table. So person maps off to the person table. Here are all the properties. These properties go off to these columns in the database. You can then extend that further and model inheritance relationships, polymorphism relationships, all using this XML so that you don't have to worry so much about it. So a good example, I'm actually writing a content management system for administering websites using Enhibernate, and the polymorphic query functionality is really handy. So, you know, website generally is arranged in a tree structure. You've got folders and items inside of folders, and I have a content management item class, which is kind of the base class, and then I have a folder class that extends that, and a folder item class that also extends off of content management item. And Enhibernate lets me just say, I want, you know, item number one. And it knows that it is a content management item. And it doesn't really care too much about what that actually is, what the concrete class is when you're actually querying it. But when it does the query, you say, give me content management item five. And it knows that this is actually a folder. So it returns you a populated instance of the folder item. And it will just do all these polymorphic queries for
you. So how does it know that it's a folder item? You tell it, like, if this column in the database is this value, it's a folder or something like that? Or?
Well, it's a little bit complicated to describe only verbally. It's one of these whiteboarded discussion things.
Well, give it a shot to see if we can do it.
So if you have in your mapping file, you've got a class called content item, and that'll have things like name, ID, parent item, and that will set up your tree structure. If you want to extend that and then make that, say, a web page item, you use this element inside the mapping file called joined subclass, and you say the base class is going to be content management item, and this new class is going to be called WebPage, and you say WebPage comes off of the WebPage table in your database, and here are all these new properties that hang off of it. So Enhibernate is doing a little bit of smarts when you go after, when you're just trying to query, say, the base class, and it figures out, and this is actually where you could run into some performance problems, I would expect. It figures out that, well, this base class actually is a type web page concrete class. So it will return you a populated web page object. And, you know, it returns, since web page extends from content item, it just returns you, you know, what looks like content item instance. But you can then interrogate it and see if it actually is it a web page.
Okay, so I'm just trying to imagine how that works from the database side. So I got one table of content management items.
Right.
And I have another table which adds some more stuff for web pages. And they're linked with a foreign key.
Right.
And so if I have a thing that's not a web page, it might have an entry in the content management
right.
item table, but not one in the web page table.
Right. It might have one in the folder table.
Okay.
Or, you know, attached file table.
So I'm just wondering if in Hibernate would have to go like, oh, is it a web page? Look in that table. Nope, not there. Is it in the folder table? Oh, yeah, it's one of those.
Unfortunately, I mean, I don't know exactly how it's implemented, but you're pretty sure that it would have to do something like that. And there are some hedges you can do against it. This example that I gave was using a method called join subclass, but there's also another one just called subclass that defines a discriminator value on that base class table. So the content item table, you would have a little, you know, car field or something that says, if this value is F, it's a folder. If it's a web page. And it will then be smart enough, it'll cut out that sort of searching join.
Okay. Yeah. See, that's what I was thinking.
So you could do it. So it gives you a lot of different ways to actually implement these things.
Okay. And so I create my objects, and I go off and create this XML mapping file. And then when I want to get one of my objects out of the database, what do I do?
You would instantiate an nhibernate session. And then you would, it's got a method off of it called get. And you would pass it, say, if you wanted to get web page number two, you would pass the type. So you'd say type of web page, pass that into the as parameter one on the get method of the session. And then the second item would be the primary key value, so two. And it knows to go how to load that up, and it just gives you a populated instance.
Ah, okay. And then the session, you said the session object manages the persistence. So, like, let's say I changed my object.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have to, like, then say put it back or save it?
Call an explicit save. The recommendation is that if you modify an object for transaction reasons, you would want to pass that same object back to the save method on that session. But nhibernate also uses something called I'm blanking on the actual term, but it will write changes behind you. So if you have a bunch of objects that are associated with the nhibernate session and you modify, you know, 6 out of 10 of them and you just sort of go on your merry way, at some point you can call the flush method on the nhibernate session, and it will save any of the changes that have been made to any of the objects that are associated to that session. Transparent write behind, that is the term that they call it.
Is that like, so writing on a different thread, then it's going to just update your database, or?
I think it happens on the same thread, but I'd have to look into that.
Oh, okay, because I'm just, with the way you describe it, like transparent write behind makes it sound to me like, you know, it's going to at some point save these things, and we just don't know exactly when that's going to happen. Whereas if I said, oh, it's going to happen when I call the session save method or whatever, then, you know, then it would be on the same thread probably.
Well, one of the things with transparent write behind is that it gives you this abstraction so that nhibernate can batch up a lot of things, a lot of your saves, and try to optimize your database performance. So, if you're doing the more recommended model where you are explicitly calling save and passing the object that you have modified that you want to get saved, if you don't call flush right after that, you basically have said to nhibernate, look, I know this needs to get saved at some point. Could you do it when you get around to it? But if you call flush, it will then do all of these changes. So,
oh, okay.
And
so
it gives you the ability to batch up changes and do a whole bunch of things at once.
So it's going to build up like a queue of objects that need to get saved. It's
right.
going to try to push a batch of SQL all at once.
Right.
That's kind of cool.
It is actually pretty cool. And it's got a lot of stuff like concurrency management is coming out of it. Transaction management is also available. So
that was my next big question is transactions, because I'm curious now. The problem with the queue sort of scenario is that if it batches things that maybe should be in different transactions, you know, that would be
right.
kind of weird. So I don't know, how does it manage transactions?
Well, if you're going to do it with the more explicit save model and saying, I would like you to save all of these things now for me,
mm-hmm.
or batch these as a unit, you would say to the and hibernate session, begin transaction. And then you just start calling save and passing in the objects that you want to have happen. And then you call flush, and if it doesn't die on you, you call commit transaction, and it's just done all those things as a unit for you.
Oh, okay. So you're managing a transaction just like you would with ADO, just pretty much, right?
Right.
Okay. Interesting. Now, has this been ported to .NET 2.0 yet?
The samples that I'm doing are all running on 2.0,
uh-huh.
Which I can kind of, I'm mind reading you at this point. I think
okay.
that you're about ready to ask, does it support generics?
How did you know?
the big downside is that right now it does not explicitly support generics.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a big bummer, because for all the lazy loading functionality, it's like if you want to load the collections of other related objects off of your business objects. And Hibernate wants you to always use the collection interface. So, you know, you might have a list of these objects, and you would typically want to do it as, say, ArrayList. But instead of actually using ArrayList on your domain objects, you would use iList. So system.collection.iList. And what that allows in Hibernate to do is that when in Hibernate populates your object, it sticks in an iList lazy loading proxy on that instance. And then when you hit it, it loads it up. So the bummer is that, you know, using 2.0, you really would want to have a type safe collection of these things.
Oh,
these
yeah.
generics. But it's not done yet. And
well, I'm sure they're working on
they're
it.
They're
right?
definitely working
yeah.
on it. And there are non and Hibernate blessed implementations that are out there, so people are doing it right now.
Oh, sure. Yeah, because that would be very, very cool. But, to take something like this kind of a mature framework and then insert something as radical as generics into it is a major...
Well, and one thing that is really, I think really had, the nHibernate team really had going for it is that they said, we're not going to try to get too .NET specific with the implementation. I mean, we're going to write the code so it utilizes .NET features, but we're going to try to do a really high-fidelity port of the Hibernate framework from Java so that all the XML is the same, the class names are basically the same, and the Java didn't get generics until very recently, so it just hasn't.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
they haven't got around to it.
Well, you know, they have to catch up.
This is true. This is very true. But I'm actually really excited about D-Link, the D-Link project that's
uh-huh.
coming out from Microsoft.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to see what they're going to do for that, because it would be better to go with the Microsoft Unified Blessed model of doing development.
Well, eventually it'll get there. But I think that was the reason why Object Spaces was killed, because they knew this was coming, and it is very, very cool.
Right.
And it supports a lot more scenarios. So, yeah, it's very pretty interesting stuff.
Yep.
But but that's a ways away still. Who knows how long that's going to be before it gets here. So in the meantime, nHibernate is an interesting solution.
That's a good bet for right now.
Yeah. And We are about out of time.
All right.
But thanks for a lot for stopping by and kind of you piqued my interest again about Enhibernate. I'll have to, maybe I could spend some time on that. Yeah, like I've got lots of that.
Right? Yeah, I hear you. So, great.
All right, thanks.
Thanks very much.
Benjamin Day, ladies and gentlemen. Enhibernate. Interesting stuff, isn't it? You know? These kind of open source frameworks, you know, sometimes they're pretty valuable things. And, you know, and go take a look at it. I don't know. Maybe you'll like it. Hey, here's an interesting viewer mail from Christian who says he's on a trip through Europe and heard them in the car. And he says, pleasure. Thanks for doing these and please do more. Well, Christian, we will do more because we're about giving you guys pleasure, architecture pleasure, here on ArtCast.